Okay, so hi everyone, I'm Dr. Luke Telford, I'm a lecturer at the University of York. Today my presentation is going to be with Dr. Jonathan Wistow of Durham University, entitled Levelling Up, Left Behind Redcar and Cleveland in North East England. The presentation itself then takes quite a broad sweep. The first half is very much about exploring a recent qualitative study that me and Jonathan have been engaged in about a year or so ago now, and we'll be looking at the evolution of a left behind locality where we interviewed 25 residents, getting a sense of the area and some of its localised problems. And the second part, Jonathan, will be a bit more theoretical or philosophical, looking at how the left behind issue more broadly embodies a sense of loss allocation within the UK social contract and neoliberalised political economy. And as has been pointed out a couple of times at the conference so far, we argue that really it's transformative political economic change. We can bring about a couple of micro, meso level policy mechanisms, but given the embedded, historic, deep-rooted nature of this problem, it's really only a new economic model, a post-neoliberalised model that can significantly sort out some of these issues in places like Redcar and Cleveland. Now, as you can see on the board, the arguments are generally informed by two books, one of which was out last December, just before Christmas, and of course Jonathan's book on there as well, which is a really decent book. I would encourage you all to take a look at that. So just a little bit of history then, social history, about this place. This encapsulates some of the left behind tendencies relatively well. Redcar and Cleveland, a local authority district in the sub-region of Teesside in northeast of England, an area that I myself live and have grown up in over the last 29 years. Its area's history very much is tethered to the broader economic development of Teesside, as what commentators cast as an industrial powerhouse during large parts of the 19th and particularly the early 20th century. To cut a very long historical story short in the space of a couple of minutes, basically in 1850, two local businessmen stumbled across what was cast as a magnificent supply of workable ironstone in the Cleveland Hills, which gave rise to the area's great iron and steel rush. People emigrated from quite far, including from Devon and Ireland, to acquire industrial work. And like many areas across the Western world, this is, you know, not just unique to Northern England, including America, parts of Europe. These industrialised places became defined by their manufacturing base. William Gladstone, for instance, in the late 19th century, remarked how this was an infant Hercules. It was a burgeoning industrial powerhouse. Jump forward, though, a little bit in the historical timeline, and particularly as capitalism stumbled on a series of systemic crises in the UK in the 1970s, stagflation, winter of discontent, and so on, we witnessed a phase shift in the political economy, with many northern industrialised powerhouses suffering quite profoundly as they witnessed their raison d'etre, really, their reason for existing, pulled away very, very quickly. And of course this mirrored the broader economic restructuring that the UK witnessed at the time, an industrialised economy to a service-based economy. Recent work by Ron Martin and colleagues a couple of years ago identified the local authority district as the second most left behind local authority in terms of the differential growth of both employment and output. And of course a key part of the UK's economic geography is this as a result of deindustrialisation and the leaving behind of these localities like Redcar and Cleveland across the north in particular, is this intensification of a north-south divide, which of course has been a key feature of the economic geography of the UK for quite a long time. Now, of course, that is somewhat simplistic in some senses, in the sense that wherever you go in the UK, including in Redcar and Cleveland, there are pockets of affluence that exist alongside spaces of deprivation. And of course, the North is not homogeneous. So when we consider this in a historical, political, economic context, I think, you know, Ron mentioned yesterday, it's not that these places have been left behind, but it's almost like they've been purposely kept behind. And I think that's a really interesting way to frame it. So in terms of political change then, the rise of anti-system politics or populism, Redcar and Cleveland is also central to that somewhat inevitably. Voted heavily for Brexit back in 2016, and since 2019, when we had the historic collapse of what was conceptualised as the Red Wall, where many areas from North Wales right up to the top of North East England that had historically elected a Labour MP, voted a Conservative MP, often for the first time in their electoral history. And that was the case with the two constituencies over the last couple of general elections in Redcar and Cleveland. It's also central to the levelling up agenda, which of course has been mentioned a couple of times over the last 2 days. It was rejected in round one in 2021, of course the competitive marketised funding model that local councils have to bid or beg for funds through. But it was successful earlier on this year. It won about 20 million quid through round two, which, digging in, I don't have time to go into what that's for, but it's a couple of vanity and aesthetic projects in the local area, certainly not anything transformative. So the levelling up agenda more broadly then, of course, as you'll all be aware, Boris Johnson's government elected in late 2019 on the premise of getting Brexit done and levelling up this deeply imbalanced economy. After a long delay, the white paper, of course, was published at the start of early last year. Of course, we don't have time to go into that, but it's a lengthy document, as Ron pointed out, about 300 odd pages. And a core part of it are these 12 missions to be achieved by 2030. So there's a sense of longevity in there to an extent, acknowledging that some of these problems are going to take quite a long time to address. They're based upon raising pay, for instance, employment, productivity, achieving closer to London standards in public transport nationwide, increasing high skills training, and a general premise to share wealth and opportunity more evenly across the UK. As you can see on the board, being subject to various academic critique is a real kind of burgeoning literature on this. Key ones are that very ambiguous. It means everything, so it doesn't really mean anything in particular. I've put ignores, but it would probably be more accurate to say gives insufficient attention to the political economy, capitalism's role in inevitably shaping geographical, giving rise to geographical inequalities by its very nature. The lack of resources that are required, of course, comparisons are often drawn to Germany in the 1990s. To level up east and west, and some of the resources that were directed into that over a long period of time. Levelling up fund absolutely pales in comparison to that amount of money. And as Ron and Peter have recently pointed out, it largely ignores London's role in shaping these place-based inequalities and fails to challenge the capital's dominance. So just a brief flavour of some of the empirical findings then from our interviews in the local area. Particularly the older age respondents then were quite nostalgic for the past, inevitably. They'd witnessed a different constitution in the local area and the local labour market, often recalling industrial work with a great sense of pride and social purpose, really. They were very sad that it had massively diminished in the area. Worth pointing out that there still is pockets of decent employment in the broader Teesside sub-region. There's still a decent-sized chemicals base, for instance, but there was a sense that it was far more difficult to get into these labour markets today. They recalled industry as offering the area a sense of its fundamental kind of economic purpose and identity ICI, which was Imperial Chemicals Industry, in its heyday in Teesside, it employed nearly 40,000 people, had two sites, one of which was in Redcar in Cleveland, and that diminished really from the 90s onwards. So there'd been a shift really in the local area from this industrial relative stability, not to romanticise the past of course, into this deindustrialised insecurity with that broader shift to neoliberal political economy. Many people, particularly who were in low-paid work that was non-unionised and degrading, didn't really offer any kind of tools for identity formation, were keen to emphasise how a lot of the happiness had been emptied out of their work. It was something that they just engaged in, instrumentally to pay the bills, but of course in the current climate that was proving more and more difficult. A quick scan of the public health outcomes framework then shows that there's a nearly 10-year inequality gap for life expectancy at birth for men and 8 years for women in the local authority district. 27% of children under 16 in the area live in relative poverty, compared to about 20% for the national average. And around 67% of people in employment in Redcar and Cleveland are in employment in comparison to about 25% for the national average. And some basic descriptive statistics from the ONS, I think from last year, indicate that the average full-time worker's gross weekly pay in the area stood at £568, and that's in comparison to the UK average of £642, relates somewhat to a point Ron just made. And you can see, of course, across the month, and particularly annually, that's a sizeable drop in the average living standards for people living in the local authority. So, very quickly, just some qualitative data on the board there. So Anne is retired, previously worked in the textiles industry that again diminished from the 80s onwards. She told me how the area has lost loads of jobs. You used to leave school, you knew you could get a job, especially in the 60s, that kind of post-war golden age of capitalism, so it was called. But you can't now, there are no decent jobs. Very difficult for young people. There is little for them to be proud about. Mary also retired, and she spoke of how work, well, it has all gone. No industry, no factories, nothing. Easier to get work years ago. My younger ones, children, are working, but I wouldn't like to be them now. Oh no. So a local form of economic development as part of Levelling Up that many of you might have heard about is Teesworks, which is one of the UK's free ports, which opened in the local authority district in 2021. Now scholars working on this, a burgeoning literature, have talked about how they're kind of special economic zones, which are prominent across the world, and they often involve a deregulatory market environment, a neoliberalised form of development, where taxes, tariffs, regulations are diminished to try and incentivise capital investment. Being subject to critique, a really good paper in the British Journal of Criminology that was out earlier this year by Alex Hall and colleagues spoke about how they've been associated with a huge variety of environmental social problems and have also been known to facilitate various forms of crime, such as drug markets, for instance. A problem that's attracted some degree of national attention in the area at the Freeport is the periodic mass death of thousands of marine life, particularly crabs, which has been linked to dredging at the Freeport, which has disturbed poisonous chemicals in the ocean sediment that had been there for a long period of time because of the area's former industry. Now, there was a government commissioned investigation into this, with the results announced just before Christmas of last year, that claimed it was exceptionally unlikely that dredging had caused these mass mortalities. But research by various, collaborative research by various institutions at Durham, York, and a few others, by researchers that was commissioned by the fishing industry, found that pyridine, the chemical released by dredging, is the probable cause, and that development should be stopped or at least paused until more research is conducted. Interestingly, though, and as I've said to a couple of people, residents were keen to gloss over some of these problems that have emerged. They instead focused on the potential of the Freeport to potentially revive the area in light of this ongoing green and energy transition, suggesting that, you know, well, if it brings decent jobs in, it's just what the area needs in order for it to be revived. And particularly after perceived years of economic neglect and abandonment, you know, at least it was some form of investment in the area. Again, just some qualitative data on the board there. So David, again retired, spoke about how the Labour Party has done nothing for the North East, neither has the Conservative Party. But at the moment, even though I was totally against creating a mayor for this invisible Tees Valley, ironically, I think what they are doing at Teesport and bringing jobs in, they are doing a marvellous thing. The North East might flourish again. Gareth, in his mid-50s, fairly decent paid job with the NHS in mental health support, told me how Ben Howshan, who's the local Tees Valley mayor, seems to have done a good job. He's pushing the levelling up agenda, trying to bring as much investment as he can, Freeport, airport, renewable energy, which is the future. He is talking about these being good, well-paid jobs, but until we see it, it is just what he is saying.
So I'll take over here, and as Luke says, I'm introducing a bit more of a philosophical dimension. So see what you think of it. But what we've done, and we do this in the book we've done together, is talk about left behind places relative to this concept of loss allocation. Drawing on one of the founders of the UK social policy discipline, Richard Titmuss, and his work in Commitment to Welfare. And he said then, his idea was that progress, not a radical idea, but progress is not equally shared in societies. And his view then is that we have socially caused diswelfares that are the price some people pay for other people's progress. And there's a really nice link, I think, here with spatial justice and spatial distribution. And he calls these then social costs and insecurities. These are then, for him, forms of loss allocation that people experience through the progress, the benefits other people are getting out of being members of a society. And Titmuss wrote this at the height of the UK welfare state, the height of the redistributive social contract in the UK. And he'd still considered then the role of the welfare state, the nation building through that, was a partial compensation for the progress some people were bearing. And as we say, things have changed very much since then. Capitalism has become much more competitive and individualistic since. So there is this idea, as Luke said as well, but it's worth repeating that, you know, capitalism is a competitive system. There are winners and losers in capitalism, and we see some quite profound spatial distributions based around those. Also in the UK, we've described this phase shift, this shift in the late 1970s onwards to a more form of a neoliberal, post-industrial, rentier capitalism, in which macroeconomic policy has had a declining significance in the work of Aaron Davis, very good book on the Treasury in that respect and what the Treasury has done to itself and the country in terms of having less involvement in macroeconomic policy. And it's obviously no surprise to people here then that the UK is unusually centralised in economic, political, cultural, social systems. Many people's research would say it's one of the most unequal countries in the developed world and has one of the most centralised major developed economies. And all of this based around London and the South East, a key part of the left behind problem, a key part of the levelling up agenda that is in the white paper, but not dealt with, we think, in a sufficient way to understand the implications of that for spatial disparities in the policy responses. And also we should mention then austerity as well has had a very spatial dimension too. The cuts that we've seen in the size of the state have fallen in the areas, you know, really systematically where there's the greatest need. So one way to think about this is then thinking about this through social contract theory. The idea here that states, societies, gain their justification through the consent of individuals. There is a deal here between people and the state. And our argument is that, you know, people are actually getting a very bad deal out of society. We see it in spatial inequalities. We see that then very mapped very neatly onto other types of social outcomes, like health inequalities, educational inequalities, right across the board, and with places like Redcar and Cleveland then being particularly affected in that respect. And the idea of social contract theory is we as citizens, we're giving away some of our individual freedom. We're giving it to the state through entering into a political community, and we transfer our sovereignty to government on the basis it will act in our best interest. So there is a contract, there is a deal there in this kind of theory of the role of states. I like the work of Rousseau, not a particularly contemporary thinker, as you all know, but he does two good things, I think, in his work. One, he uses the idea of a social contract in an analytical way, in a way that it puts a lens on society and asks questions that test what kind of position people find themselves in a free society. And is this mutually beneficial? Are our individual outcomes, how do they compare with the overall social outcomes and our social position, our status? He also then is very prescriptive. He believes in greater equality. I do too, but me and Rousseau, I think, are at odds with the direction of societies. 2 minutes yet. So he has a normative goal that we should have greater equality as a basis for freedom to. It frees us up to fulfil our potential from starting from a more level playing field. In the UK, as I say, I think we've gone in a very different direction since the 1970s. There was a real shift in attitudes away from collectivism to individualism. And the Thatcher governments tapped into this and fostered it and really pushed that agenda. We can link this to philosophers like Herbert Spencer around the survival of the fittest, Hayek around sort of antagonism to the welfare state in terms of the free functioning of markets, and people like Charles Murray around dependency and too much state, too much social collective provision causing dependency. We also have an element of possessive individualism, which here, as I say here, it's inherently conservative. It's not about challenging the distribution. How things are ordered in terms of inequalities are viewed to be quite natural and a good sort of allocation of resources. And I would argue that these are, uncomfortably for me, two quite strong standpoints influencing the UK social contract. And, you know, reasonably popular, certainly not unpopular enough to move out of this phase shift that we're describing from the 1980s onwards and radically transform the nature of the political economy. I'll just go quickly to our last slide on the conclusion then. So the argument here, and I think there's quite a lot of agreement in terms of the levelling up agenda, the left behind problem. If we really want to narrow spatial disparities, if that's the purpose of the levelling up agenda, to close gaps between the best and worst performing areas, then we do need a different kind of policy. We need to bring macroeconomic policy back in to enable transformative change. As Luke said, similar to the scale of what took place in Germany in the post-Cold War period, similar to what the UK 2070 Commission has recommended in the past. And we need a sustained step change in the way we do things, proportionate to need, redistributive around need and productivity, targeting things in a proportionate way that will address this systemic form of loss allocation. But I'm not too optimistic. I don't think Luke is either. It's a bit of a downer at the end. But we think we still remain quite wed to this kind of possessive individualist social contract. Things are rigged in this respect, but there is a degree of popular support or not popular dissent for moving away from that. And if we don't have that support for this step change, then these kinds of spatial disparities are likely to continue, you know, long into the future. But yeah, that's us. Thank you.